KGGF time, 7:40 on this Wednesday. I'm Shane Neal, filling in for James this week. And like I said yesterday, I miss him too, so I know we're going to get to Tuesday together. But it's time for our weekly conversation with the good folks from K-State Research and Extension. And we're joined by Jesse and Adavin this morning. Good morning. How are both of you?
Doing good. Good morning.
It was nice feeling the cooler temperatures as I walked out of the house this morning.
Amen. Amen. I don't think 88's ever going to feel as good as it does today.
No. But you should start seeing some fall color change here pretty soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we got a lot of great stuff to talk about today, so what's on the docket?
David and I have a couple of events that we want to talk about before we get started.
Sure.
But after that, I'm going to talk about seed saving.
Great.
Yeah, so the event I wanted to talk a little bit about is a pond workshop I have coming up on the 26th of this month, so the last Tuesday of the month. And it will be held at the Research Center in Parsons, right there on the corner of 400 and Ness Road. So usually I hold pond workshops, you know, in the spring, right before, you know, the weather gets hot and people really start to see problems with aquatic weeds and algae on their ponds. This workshop is going to be a little bit different. Joe, our aquatic specialist at K-State, he's going to be coming down and he's going to be talking about topics related to managing ponds with low water levels, because unfortunately we haven't seen those big rains to get a lot of runoff into these ponds. So just going over topics relating to maybe fixing leaky ponds while the water level is low, or redoing a pond, water quality concerns for livestock, different topics along that line. And of course, he will still be talking a little bit about managing fish in ponds and aquatic weed control, because those are always really popular topics.
Well, and that's cool that, you know, you're kind of taking advantage of the situation in a way where, you know, obviously, like you mentioned, it's been kind of a slow year in terms of getting rain, and it's been a very dry summer, but you know, making the most of kind of the cards you're dealt, and talking more about some stuff that maybe you wouldn't have as much time to talk about in a normal year.
Yeah, exactly.
On my end of the ag agent spectrum, today is the first Wednesday of the month, which means that K-State's Garden Hour webinar is today, and I am actually giving the webinar from noon to one on saving seeds and the process that you'd go through. You're going to get a little preview of that, but I only have 20 minutes here as opposed to 45 minutes in the webinar. So I definitely won't be able to cover everything right now, but essentially what I'm going to do here in just a second is give you a rundown on the basics of seed saving. But if you are interested in the webinar series, if you've already registered, you should still be able to get into the webinar with the Zoom link that you got when you originally registered, but you can also register on the K-State website if this is the first topic of the year that has drawn your interest and you want to be there live in person. So I am giving the seed saving presentation. It was very interesting going through and developing the presentation for this webinar, because while I have a lot of experience with fruits and vegetables, I don't have a ton of experience, personal experience, with seed saving. And so it was fascinating diving through these resources like the Seed Savers Exchange seed saving guide, to get a good look at the steps that you have to go through for seed saving. And so there's a very specific type of gardener that seed saving is going to apply to. Seed saving might actually be for you if you wanted to save money on garden inputs, and that's kind of where I originally approached the seed saving perspective from. But a lot of seed saving is really interested in genetic diversity and preservation of specific varieties. So with any type of project that you're doing, where you have a multitude of different options for how you approach it, this is true for the stock market, it's true for biology too. Diversity mitigates risk. And so the more genetic diversity you have in terms of varieties for fruits and vegetables, the less likely you are going to see something come in and completely wipe out an entire population. So you see that with Dutch elm disease, with a lot of the American elms that are planted down here in Southeast Kansas, Northeast Oklahoma. It's pretty similar for fruits and vegetables as well. For example, bananas. About 98% of all bananas in the world are one specific variety. And so there is a very good chance that bananas will go extinct, at least in my lifetime, because the one reason why this particular variety, it's called the Cavendish variety, is so prevalent is because it has strong resistance to Panama disease, which was absolutely wiping out banana trees at the time. And so they bred this resistance in, and it became so vital of a trait that everyone started growing Cavendish. But the problem with that is that if Panama disease mutates for some reason or overcomes the resistance that has been bred into Cavendish bananas, you're going to see pretty much all of those banana trees get wiped out, and you're not really going to have a backup plan. So being able to preserve different varieties of what we call heirloom varieties or open pollinated varieties is very helpful, and that's a lot primarily the reason why people get into seed saving. But seed saving might not be for you in very specific circumstances. If you want to try different varieties next year to experiment with how well they grow, you're not going to need to save seed from the variety that you're growing this year. If you want to harvest everything that you grow, if you don't have a ton of space and you need to make use of that to produce food, seed saving is going to, for the most part, run contrary to that, because you have to leave most garden fruits and vegetables in the ground past their harvest date. The harvest date for market is not the same as harvesting for seed for most plants, and there will be exceptions to that, which I'll touch on here in a second. But if you want hybrid varieties for your garden, you are not going to get the same characteristics out of offspring plants that you are out of parent plants during cross-pollination for hybrids. And I'll touch on why in just a second, too. There are reasons why you would want to grow hybrids, and most specifically disease resistance is the primary reason. Hybrids are much, much more disease resistant than open pollinated or heirloom varieties. So if we ever get rain, and we have a lot of rain, water and fungal diseases are going to be pretty bad, and that's going to, you can grow heirlooms in that kind of environment, but it's going to take a lot more work. So there's five steps that go into seed saving. There's the garden planning phase. There's going to be specific things you need to keep in mind when planning your garden to produce seed as opposed to producing food. You need to understand the pollination habits of what you're trying to grow. There's harvesting, there's processing and drying, and then there's the storage of the seeds. So when planning your garden, I always tell people your number one priority when planning a garden should always be to grow what you enjoy eating within the limitations of your site. So obviously, fruiting vegetables like tomato, pepper, eggplant, they're not going to do great in more shady areas. I would never be able to grow any fruiting vegetables in my backyard because it is completely shaded all hours of the day. So shade is going to be the limiting factor on how successfully your garden produces. If you are in a shadier area, leaf vegetables are the best choice. Root vegetables are a close second. And unfortunately, you would probably want to avoid fruiting vegetables like tomato. And I know that breaks a lot of people's hearts, but sometimes if you find a sunnier spot in your landscape, you can grow tomatoes in containers. And that's a suitable alternative for that. When you are shopping for varieties suitable for seed saving, you need to be looking for what are known as heirloom varieties or open pollinated varieties instead of hybrid or F1. Sometimes you'll see those listed. And I'll circle back around to why hybrids aren't suitable for seed saving here in a second. Unfortunately, there is not a lot of research at all on how suitable certain varieties of heirloom vegetables are. There's a lot more research that goes into hybrids because of that extra disease resistance. And heirloom production in general, growth and production and survivability is a lot more variable. With hybrid, you know a lot more of what you're getting. And that's not to say that there can't be specific varieties of heirloom. For example, Cherokee Purple. Cherokee Purple is such a popular heirloom variety of tomato that there is research that has been done on its suitability in different parts of the state. But there are many, many more varieties of heirlooms that you can get for pretty much every garden vegetable and probably flowers as well, than what they are going to be able to do research on. So really, they only do research, and it's kind of unfortunate, but it is like necessary for markets to understand how to sell things, that they are going to do research on the most marketable, most commercially successful varieties first, and then kind of trickle down from there when possible. So there are a couple of ways that you can assess how well an heirloom variety is going to do. One of the ways that I rely on is looking at reviews from people who are in my area. So Baker Creek is the heirloom seed company that I deal with personally. Don't really do any work with them through extension, but I do grow some of their stuff. And so what they have on their website is they've got a feature where people can leave reviews about the characteristics of the plants and the vegetables, if it is a vegetable. And they also have their specific, well, not specific, but their general growing area. So where the plant was shipped to in the United States, and you can filter based on those locations so that you can find good heirlooms or at least good information on the variety you're looking at based on location. I would also recommend, especially if you've never done heirloom vegetable growing before, to grow varieties that catch your interest from a visual standpoint. One of the best reasons to grow heirlooms is because of that visual flair that it's going to add to your garden. One of my favorites is the dragon's tongue bush bean, which is a green bean with purple stripes all along the pods. Gotta be purple for us.
Absolutely.
So that is a very fun looking plant for your garden. Even if you don't get a ton of production off of it, you're getting a visual flair to it. One of my favorites is the awesome gray poppy, which I personally, if I was developing or maintaining the variety, I probably would have called storm cloud poppy, because that's what it looks like. And it's so radically different from what you can expect from the standard species poppy. For seed saving, your main goal is to control pollination, which is going to affect the types of vegetables you have in the garden at the same time, and a little bit of how you design the garden from a layout standpoint as well. And so pollination is reproduction between two plants using gametes. In this case, the main gamete that you're concerned about is pollen. When pollen makes it to a flower, chromosomes are combined and an embryo is formed. So the specific type of cell for this type of reproduction is called a gamete. And so it has half of the number of chromosomes of the parent plant. And once it makes it to the other flower, it's combined with the half of the chromosomes from that parent plant. And so when you have two varieties that are different, you're going to get what's known as a hybrid. And sometimes this happens intentionally because there are characteristics from each parent variety that you want in the resulting offspring plant, or the F1 generation. If you are saving for seeds in a backyard setup, you are not going to have the luxury of developing and breeding that line again and again and again. So what you need is pollination between one variety. So two parent plants that have the same, pretty much the same genetics. Obviously, there's going to be a little bit of variety in there. But the offspring plant, or the seed that you're going to get, the embryo for that offspring plant, it's going to be what is known as true to type. So it is going to have most, if not all, of the characteristics of the parent plants. Whereas, you know, you combine two varieties, you get a muddled mess of genes that you have no idea how they're going to exhibit once the new plant starts growing. So you have some options for controlling pollination, and really this is the most important part, so this is where I'm going to spend the majority of my time talking. Obviously, I don't think I'm going to have enough time to get to harvesting and storage. But when you're designing your garden, you have options. You can plant only a single variety of that species. You can put physical distance between varieties of the same species, which I would honestly not recommend, especially if it's insect or wind pollinated. For spinach, the pollen grains are so fine that you have to separate varieties by up to 2 miles. So that is very unfeasible for most backyard gardeners. Planting a single variety, that can have its drawbacks because you don't know how certain varieties are going to do, especially if it's a newer variety that you want to try. You could choose varieties that have different flowering times, because if the flowers aren't open to accept that pollen, you're not going to get the cross-pollination. Or, and this is probably the most feasible for people who want to experiment with it, you could bag the flowers in order to prevent pollen from getting to them. And that only works for flowers that self-pollinate. They're what are known as perfect flowers. But things like tomatoes, for example, they are self-pollinating. So bagging those flowers, you would guarantee, at least for those bagged flowers, that you would get the resulting true-to-type seed. One thing to keep in mind about pollination, and this is probably where we're going to have to stop because we're getting close to the break, pollination only occurs within the same species. So even if you have plants that are in the same genus, for example, watermelon and cantaloupe, watermelon and cantaloupe are not in the same genus. Cucumber and cantaloupe. So they are in the same family. I believe they are in the same genus. I'm blanking on that as well. But they are not going to cross-pollinate with each other and form a hybrid because they are not the same species. There are vegetables that are of the same species. So Brassica oleraceae is the common one for vegetables that you have to keep in mind, because these are all the same species. Broccoli, cauliflower, kale, kohlrabi, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and collard greens. They are all Brassica oleraceae. They're all just a different variety of that. And so any cross-pollination between those vegetables is going to form a hybrid, which is going to be a very bizarre-looking plant. So you're going to need to limit your cross-pollination potential by maybe growing one or two of those and leaving it at that, so that you don't get a plant you're not expecting next year. One other one to mention is that beets and Swiss chard are also both the same species, so they would also do cross-pollination. But for that you would end up with probably a beet with more leafy greens, which I think is actually probably a benefit. So it's all one big experiment, and there's a lot that goes into it, and a lot that you have to keep in mind. But if you are interested in easy plants to start with, beans, peas, and tomatoes are the three that are easiest to figure out.
Well, great stuff. Thanks so much. And great information for people looking to maximize the output of their, backyard garden or whatever they're working with. So thanks so much for stopping by. We got a check of Fox News and local news on the way, and we'll have more with K-State Research and Extension right after this. It's the Mighty 690 KGGF. Today, I'm Shane Neal, filling in for James this week, and we continue our Wednesday morning docket of the program with our weekly conversation with K-State Research and Extension. And we heard from Jesse last hour. Now we're joined again by Davin. Welcome. Well, I mean, you've been here, so I've already said how are you, but exciting stuff on the docket.
Yeah. So first, for maybe folks that are just joining us for the second half, I wanted to touch on the pond workshop that we have coming up the end of the month on the 26th. So this will be an evening workshop. So folks that are working, they should have plenty of time to get off work and then stop by the workshop. And it is free to attend. So Joe Gerken, the state aquatic specialist at K-State in Manhattan, he'll be driving down and joining us for this workshop. And typically, like I mentioned in the first half, you know, pond workshops are held late spring, right before the weather gets hot and weeds and algae really take off on ponds. And this one we're holding is going to be a little bit different because it's going to be focused a little bit more on topics related to managing ponds with low water levels, which I know myself and a lot of other people have been dealing with from last year into this year. But of course, Joe will also be touching a little bit on aquatic weeds and algae management along with fish management as well, because those are really popular topics. And hopefully we can get it lined out to take folks out to a pond as well to kind of get a look at it in person as Joe discusses some different topics. So I'm looking forward to it. It should be a good program.
Yeah, and that hands-on experience obviously very valuable, so that'd be a good opportunity for people. And cool that you're having it in the evening, so people, like you said, that are at work or maybe have kids in school or whatever, still have time to get out to that.
Right, yeah. And if folks, you know, do have kids and they want to bring them with, they're of course welcome as well.
Very cool. Well, what's today's topic?
So I am going to be talking about scrapie tags for sheep and goats today. It's a question I get occasionally throughout the year, mainly for new sheep and goat producers or producers that have recently moved to Kansas. So for those that aren't familiar with scrapie tags, so scrapie tags are required by law for sheep and goats to have when they're sold or if they move locations. So in recent years, they've changed the rules just a little bit. So male sheep and goats under a year and a half old that are going into the food system don't need to have a scrapie tag, but everything else does. And scrapie tags are important because they help track where that sheep and goat was born, where it came from. And this is to help control the disease of scrapies. So scrapies is a fatal disease, and this is why it's so important to be able to track this disease, is to keep it under control. So it's not a very prevalent disease. It's less than 0.01% occurring. So they want to keep this program in place to eradicate it totally, to get up to that 100% mark, because so like I said, it's a fatal disease and it affects the central nervous system of sheep and goats. So characteristic signs of the disease are a lack of coordination, nervousness, aggressiveness, and intense rubbing. So it got the name scrapies because it was first seen in sheep, and they would scrape the wool off because they would be trying to scratch and rub on fencing or barn walls so much. And it's thought to be caused by a virus-like agent. And this is passed on primarily in the birthing fluids or in the afterbirth when those kids and lambs are born. And this is why it's so important to track why those animals came from. And a lot of times, once an animal starts showing signs of scrapies, they typically only live 6 months to a year before that disease just, you know, takes over. And unfortunately, they die from it. However, scrapies, usually it doesn't show signs in animals until they're about 2 to 5 years of age. So if you have a doe or a ewe and she's been in production a while, you know, she's had a few sets of kids and lambs by the time she shows signs of it. So your first set of scrapies tags are free through the USDA. And the scrapies tags, it has a premise ID number, which you call the USDA and they assign you a premise ID number. And what that premise ID number tells is the state that animal came from, and then your location, so your address, which of course it doesn't say your address on the tag, but in their system, they assign you a premise ID, which is, so for Kansas, it's KS, and then it's a sequence of numbers, and they have that in their system match to their address. And then it's the animal's individual number. So it would, you know, start at one and go to however many you have. So we talk about record keeping a lot just in general. So, you know, like when that goat kitted, which kids go with her, that sort of thing. So Scrapie's tags can also double as just your regular herd ID tags for record keeping purposes. And to get these tags, you can call 1-866-USDA-TAG, and they will give you that premise ID number. Once you call, it will kind of give you that automated menu. So from there, you can tell them what state you're in. And once you have that premise ID number, so they'll send you, it's either your set of first 50 or 100 tags for free, and then after that you have to buy those tags yourself. But there's a lot of different websites out there that sell the tags. You just want to make sure you buy them from a company that's certified to make those Scrapie tags, because they will have a little U.S. shield on them and say that they are unlawful to remove. And again, you don't want to remove them, because that's how they track where that animal came from. I've also gotten the question from folks that have moved to Kansas from another state if they can use the Scrapie tags they had previously in the state. And the answer to that question is no, you can't, because it, again, it tracks where specifically that animal came from. So you would want to get, and you need to get new tags that are linked to your Kansas address. Another question that comes up, especially for goats and dairy goats, is if the animal is registered, if they need to be tagged. Because for registered animals, there a lot of times people are showing those animals in registry shows, and especially dairy goats, it's not common to tag them. So a tag in their ear would look a little funny in the show ring. So if your animals are registered, then you don't need to have a Scrapie tag in their ear, because those registration papers serve the same purpose as the Scrapie tags. The registration papers tell who the breeder of the animal was, where it was born, all the same information that the Scrapie tag would. However, that animal needs to have, you know, clear tattoos that are easy to read, and also those papers need to travel with that animal. And if you are ever to sell that animal and not include its registration papers with it, then it would need a Scrapie tag.
Well, great stuff. I mean, very interesting, and especially for somebody like you said, new to the state, not even a year in yet, but always fascinating to kind of learn about the proper processes, processes, I guess that's the plural, the processes that you have to go through to maintain all this stuff. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And this also applies, so to, you know, 4-H and FFA members for fairs, we get questions around this too, because of course they have to have a Scrapie tag in their sheep or their goats to show them at fair as well.
Great information, and appreciate you stopping by. For people that maybe have more questions or want to know a little bit more, how can they get a hold of you in the Wildcat District?
Yeah, they can reach me by calling the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And great stuff, as always, from K-State Research and Extension. We got plenty more to get on to the docket today. We have two more guests, as well as taking your calls on Open Line. Let's step away for a few minutes. We'll have a check of Fox News coming up in just a few as well. It's the Mighty 690 KGGF.
Do you have questions about your insurance, Medicare? Then listen to the Mighty 690.